with us every time. It's not morning, it's afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday special, where we talk through some of the events of the week and some of the stories that may have slipped under the radar. I am Tony Groves, host of the Echo Chamber podcast, joined by my co-host Martin McMahon. We're also joined by UCD assistant professor of architecture, Orla Hegarty. Orla, how are you keeping?
Good afternoon.
Yeah, you got it right. And we're joined by friend of the pod, Sunday special regular at this stage, Emma. Emma D'Souza. Emma, how are things?
Well, you could say things are pretty good. Pretty busy, hectic, a bit chaotic north of the border at the moment.
Can I make a point? And I think you've made it in general. If anybody's following Emma on Twitter, and if you're not, I recommend you do. You'll see some of the breaking through some of the noise, but one of the most important points that this week we've seen another meltdown within the DUP. We've seen Edwin Poots, after 21 days, stand down as leader. There's going to be another election for the leadership. But some of the things that have been said, it very much strikes me that it's been covered as if this is Northern Ireland on a knife edge, that the DUP represent this huge sway of people. And you're quite adamant that that's not the case, Emma.
Yes, I am indeed. I am never ending in terms of trying to hammer home the point that despite what you might see in the headlines and the media coverage from the North, this is very much a minority that is in opposition to the Northern Ireland Protocol. It's a minority that is pushing hard for this hard Brexit. And it's a minority that is causing a lot of destabilizing protests and in some instances violence in the North over the past 6 months. And it is an ever shrinking minority. The majority of people in Northern Ireland have made significant gains over the past 23 years in building a rights-based society where we just want to move on. We are not interested in going backwards. And I think that in many ways, this outburst of pushback against that progress from some communities in the North is because of the fact that we are progressing as a society, and some would really like it if we just went back to like 1985, and it's just not the case.
Yeah, I suppose if we could reframe the week, why in your opinion was, apart from they were saying the disastrous interviews with BBC Northern Ireland, did Edwin Poots have to go?
It has been fascinating to see that the first democratically elected leader of the Democratic Unionist Party has been ousted after just 21 days as party leader. And I think we need to unpack a little bit behind why that might have happened. I think in the first instance, there was really no recovery from the rather public and brutal takedown of Arlene Foster as leader. And Edwin Poots, when he came into the position, spoke of healing and building bridges, and instead he ousted everyone who supported Geoffrey Donaldson as his competitor and brought in all of his own loyalists to positions and just cut everybody out within the party. So that was, I think, a significant problem. And then if we look at to what was the final moment that really ended Arlene Foster's position within the party, it was that vote to ban conversion therapy, where she abstained, whereas the majority of her party members voted against banning conversion therapy. So that's a rights issue there. And if we look at what happened with Edwin Poots, in the end, it was the fact that he merely agreed to implement what was already agreed in New Decade, New Approach, to bring in a cultural package of language and culture rights, including the Irish language. And that, again, is a rights issue. And because of the fact that it is bringing in more rights in the North, DUP leaders seemingly are taken down. So it's another example, I think, of how the party is still very much caught in the past with this never, never, never mantra, where any progress that's seen as something for them ones is pushed back against. So it's, I think, a bigger issue for the party. It's going to be hard to see how Geoffrey Donaldson, who is, you know, considered to be a shoe-in for taking over, is going to do things any differently.
Can I ask, Emma, during the week here, we had high-profile politicians talking about parity of esteem for the DUP. What do you think about parity of esteem for the DUP after the week that's just been?
Well, I think parity of esteem in the North has not been fully realized, full stop. You know, parity of esteem within the Good Friday Agreement is ensuring really that there is equality between both communities, and we don't have that north of the border. It just doesn't exist yet. There still is a big question mark over that. And I think that we see that evidence this week when you're talking about some high profile politicians. If we look also to the pushback that was received from unionist politicians at the statement from Leo Varadkar that he supports the United Ireland and would like to see that in his lifetime. And unionist politicians, including the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, responded that that was, you know, an unwelcome comment and heavily criticized Leo Varadkar for making that statement, which raises the question of, can nationalists not be nationalists? Because, of course, the Good Friday Agreement, including parity of esteem, allows us to aspire and, you know, call for a United Ireland and support that. So the fact that that was so heavily criticized from unionist politicians shows that parity of esteem is really not something we have here in the North yet.
And do you believe that the Irish language, the introduction of rights towards the Irish language, do you think that's actually the issue, or do you think there's something deeper?
I think that we're in an election period, so the DUP are thinking very much about the next assembly election. And even though the agreement that was made this week, which is quite notable for the fact that Sinn Féin went around the DUP and outmaneuvered them by going to the British government to bring forward this legislation, that in itself is quite remarkable. They weren't willing to get taken into another, you know, standoff between the DUP and Sinn Féin over Irish language rights, because they've done that before. We've been here before. We've already went through it. We're not keen to do it again. And that was in itself quite a remarkable political move from Sinn Féin. And I think that even though it's simply the enactment of already agreed legislation in New Decade, New Approach, it will be seen by some within the unionist community as a win for Sinn Féin, and the DUP are then pushing back against that because that might negatively impact them in the polls. We saw recently in some of the polls coming out from the North that the DUP's vote share is significantly dropping, with them now vying for second place with the Alliance Party. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is in the frame and the context of an assembly election.
Just on the New Decade, New Approaches, for the benefit of listeners, we are hoping to speak to Louise Malander and Kieran McAvoy on that, who signed the letter this week, in relation to that situation. So hopefully we'll bring you that in the week as well, because as I said to Martin the other day, we seem to cover the North more than we do the South these days, but that's where it's going. There is one thing, and I don't know how you feel about it, but Emma, but I'd be interested to get your insight on it. How do you feel about the coverage of, say, for example, you've made it very clear that Edwin Poots was just guilty of trying to implement something they've already agreed to twice, yet it's been referred to several times in Irish media and by RT and as concessions, as if the framing of it seems strange to me.
Yeah, there is actually, in my mind, I am a bit concerned in terms of the media coverage around the North at the moment. Not just in terms of how this is being framed as a concession, when it isn't a concession to bring forward already agreed legislation, but also in terms of the coverage we're seeing with that minority that are so vocal in terms of their opposition against Northern Ireland Protocol. We have seen threats of violence being put into the media this week and platformed, and I think that's really quite reckless. And we see that, for example, the LCC, who's the Loyalist Communities Council, who represents a number of illegal paramilitary organizations, is being, you know, put in the media as if there's some sort of legitimate mandated stakeholder in Northern Ireland. And I think that that really is something to be aware of and to be concerned of, and which is why I try so hard with the platform that I do have to keep pushing through the fact that there is a massive middle ground in the North. And they're growing, and they are not interested in this, you know, this whole narrative that's being painted. It depicts Northern Ireland as a place at odds with each other, and it's just not reflective of reality on the ground. We saw this week at that protest on Friday, it was stated that they were going to march in their thousands down to Dublin. I'm not sure why they're heading to Dublin, considering that Westminster negotiated and brought through and ratified the Northern Ireland Protocol, but that's a whole other thing in itself. But the fact is that it's hundreds that are gathering at these protests in Northern Ireland. This is not a significant portion of the society. It's only even 1% of the population of Northern Ireland. And you have to really look at the wider context in terms of what people in the North want. What people in the North want is stability. They voted overwhelmingly for the Good Friday Agreement. They didn't vote for Brexit. And they certainly aren't keen on, you know, scrapping the Good Friday Agreement in the name of a hard Brexit that nobody here voted for in the first place. Well, nobody, asterisk, majority.
All of that said, Emma, there's a very real danger that they're going to pull down the assembly. A very real danger that they're going to pull it down.
That's true. And you have to wonder, in terms of strategy, if that really is the smartest decision to make for the DUP, because they're not doing well in the polls. The Northern Ireland Protocol, as much as the rhetoric has called for it to be removed for the last 6 months, it hasn't been removed and it isn't going to be removed. We haven't seen any give really from Westminster or from the EU in terms of what's going to happen with the Northern Ireland Protocol. It is international law. So I think that it's a risky strategy from the DUP in terms of when they do go to the polls. And if they're seen as being the party that brings down the assembly, then that also stands to be to have a negative effect for them on the ground as well. I think it's interesting if you look at the recent Northern Irish Life and Times survey, which showed more and more people in the north are moving away from the labels of unionist or nationalist. And also an emergence of a Northern Irish identity as well, coming out quite strong, and people moving away from a British identity, particularly those that are in the younger category. So we see in the Good Friday Agreement generation, those who are aged 18 to 24, only 14% of those identified as British, whereas 36% said they were Northern Irish and 34% Irish. So we are in the middle of quite a period of flux in politics in the north, but also a period of flux in terms of identity and politics and belief systems, with really this middle ground, a new generation coming up. And I think that this next assembly election, whenever it falls, if it's in the autumn or if they actually manage to make it all the way to next May, it does stand to be a game changer in Northern Irish politics. And I myself will be pushing very hard to try and get as many people on the electoral register as possible to get out and vote, because you often feel in Northern Ireland that you can't make a difference, but the reality is each and every one of us has the ability to make a difference through our vote. And that'll be my message before the election.
Emma, thanks so much for that. We are going to move on to housing, but I think we may revisit part of this if there's any questions or anything comes up in the meantime. But I think it's fascinating. We'll continue to cover it on across the podcast, but you've been brilliant in terms of your social media coverage and continuing to speak out. So we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us again this morning. I know I'm always, poor Emma makes a good point, and Tony's sending WhatsApp saying, come on. Thanks for that. Orla, can I come to you on housing? We have had an interesting week again, but one of the most interesting things was a comment made by the Taoiseach saying that more or less, I'm going to paraphrase, but house prices aren't as bad as they were at the peak before the global financial crisis, as if that was a kind of, sure, it's not as bad as people are making out. You didn't think that stacked up even.
Well, I it's like everything, there's always some truth in it. And then you need to maybe dig a little bit deeper to look at the bigger picture. So, I suppose politically, when people make statements, they don't do what I'm doing, which is in the small print, you're saying, and this is where I found it, and these are the numbers. So I'm not quite sure what statistic was being used there. So, we can't say right or wrong, I suppose. What I was looking at on the back of it was what are the actual numbers for the things that really matter. So I had a look at the actual new house prices back in 2006 and now, and there's quite a big difference. These are available from the stamp duty payments, so anybody who buys a house pays stamp duty, and that's all collated by the CSO. So Permanent TSB reported back in 2006, which was the one I could find, that a new house nationally average price was about 302,000, and the latest figures from the CSO put it at 406,000 now. So that's a fairly big jump on new build prices. People were then asking me what was happening with new and second hand. So again, looking at the numbers, the new and secondhand in Dublin, because Dublin, I suppose, is where it's most sharp and most acute. New and secondhand got up to 427,000 in 2006, but is now at 500,000. And I think maybe what's been, maybe what people are not seeing is we have an index called the Residential Property Price Index, which basically starts at 100 at some point in time and then goes up and down. So it's a way of benchmarking, you know, how things were in the past and how they are now, because every property is different. And even within an estate, of a house sold in 2006 and it's selling now, it might be, you know, on a corner or have an extension. So you can't really do direct comparisons. But the problem with that index, maybe, which is what was being used during the week, is it only includes household buyers. So all of the activity that's going on with the investment funds buying estates in Kildare for 400,000, 450,000, then buying apartments in Dublin for 500,000, 600,000, 700,000. None of that has been picked up on the residential property price index because it's not household buyers. So effectively, all of the apartment building in Dublin is staying in funds and changing hands as an entire block. That doesn't appear at all. So the impact that that's having on the market doesn't show up in the residential property price index. And maybe that's what some of the confusion was during the week, that if you look at the index, you're saying, well, we're still below peak. But if you're actually out in the market, you know, there's more going on.
I just recall a comment from Dara O'Brien, the housing minister, saying that he bought, you know, I think he bought around 06 and he fell into negative equity. And he said lots of his friends did the same. And he said, and I'll never want to go back there again. And, you know, when you say something as flippant off that, it kind of shows what the mentality was about inflating the loan book prices, the bank, the values and these the property prices, in effect, to bring people out of negative equity. Again,
you see, I think that's legitimate, Tony. I mean, you know, it's legitimate to say there are loads of people who borrowed too much, were encouraged to borrow too much. Have had 10 really difficult years where they've been trying to get out of debt, where they couldn't move house, where other things were compromised, you know. So I think, you know, we have to protect those people again. You know, we can't crash the market for them either. And, you know, so any policy needs to respect that. I think the problem is, instead of saying we need to get back up to those price levels so that their prices are okay, you know, that's not solving the affordability problem. The problem was they borrowed too much. Getting a new generation to borrow too much is not the solution to that.
Well, that's been suggested this week again. That was suggested this week by the Tánaiste. It was suggested in the Dáil that we look at the mortgage rules, and it was suggested then he put a tweet himself saying that he welcomes the central bank are going to review the mortgage rules. And I say this as someone who helped introduce 100% mortgages. You know this, Earl. I helped introduce 100% mortgages to Ireland via Royal Bank of Scotland. I was one of the first people to launch it into the market, and it was disastrous. Mm. So,
but debt isn't the answer to anything. It's not the answer. But most particularly, it's not debt to build a house. It's debt to pay a margin and an inflated land price, you know, which is even worse. You know, developers are building in the commuter belt, the more outer commuter belt, and selling 3-bedroom houses for 200,000. Now, they're not doing that out of charity. You know, you can buy a house in Carlow or Wexford or Sligo for 200,000, a new build house. It's the same building regulations in Dublin. So if you're being asked to pay 450,000 in Dublin, it's not the bricks and mortar. And I don't think people should be borrowing to pay expectation and land values, because it's back to where we were, which is a race of inflating and inflating it. And there's a systemic risk there that's beyond the housing system. It's into the economy, you know. Like some of this policy is putting the economy at risk, because if people can't afford to live in Dublin, we're not competitive. You know, if people are paying too much money for rent and mortgages, they don't have money to spend in the shops and in the restaurants and in everything else. So the money's not circulating. It's just all going into housing. So, you know, in having a policy of high price housing, which is seems to be what's bedded down now, you know, with affordable housing going up to 450,000-500,000 in Dublin and Dunleary, that's a threat to a lot of people. You know, there might be a small number of people who can borrow 300,000 and have now will get a second mortgage for another 150. So in the short term, that's going to help them. But it's a very small number, and it's not very scalable if it has to be subsidised to that level.
Orla, is there a danger that this is, or, you know, is this spiralling out of control? I mean, the percentages we see in the rises in prices and rents, there's no reductions on the horizon, and yet wages haven't matched these huge increases. Is it actually stoppable? Is it actually anything anybody can do? And I mean, I know he's promised, Farquhar has promised 40,000 houses a year, 10 years out from now, but this needs to be addressed in 10 months to give people a chance.
I mean, the other thing I would challenge is, you know, the idea that supply, you know, the supply thing, is if we supply more housing and we have a supply target, it'll solve the problem. That just doesn't understand the issue. An extra, I'm trying to remember the statistic now, but another 5,000 houses in Dublin built this year would take $5,000 or $7,000 off a house price. So the impact of more houses is very marginal on the price in terms of making it more affordable. We're now at the stage where everything is overpriced by about a third.
The estimate is if you take all the Airbnb and all the short-term let stock out, I think it was 10-day supply in Dublin. Was that the statistic? Again, this is Ronan Lyons I'm quoting, not my favourite person, but nonetheless, he's...
I would love to see more economic analysis, to be honest. I think a lot of the economic analysis is very, very simplistic. You know, if we supply more, prices will come down. Yeah, but what's the risk there? The risk of crashing people into negative equity if you just flood the market with, more housing. The risk of overinflating the construction industry and having poor quality. Like, it has to be managed. We're not ordering in, you know, washing machines from Germany where you can go from ordering 100 to ordering 10,000. They have to be produced, and people, you know, it's very labor intensive. All of that has to be thought about, what is doable. And the other thing that I suppose needs to be questioned hard is, why is it always about new build? You know, we're trying to be sustainable. We have acres of vacancy and underused property in cities and regional towns and suburbs. All of that could provide huge amount of supply. And it was intended in the Rebuilding Ireland plan that would be tapped into. And that could happen pretty quickly, and it would give people decent places to live in locations with infrastructure and bus routes and schools and, you know, all the things that are there already. So I think the narrative of it has to be new build is coming from the property sector, obviously. The narrative that it costs 400,000 to build in Dublin is also coming from the same sector. And the narrative that we don't need family homes, you know, again, needs to be challenged hard. There's no evidence for that.
Just the last on that, though, it's interesting because there's a lot going on in terms of dereliction and property sitting vacant. I know Killian Woods has a piece again today in the Business Post about the amount of luxury apartments sitting vacant and the amount of family homes that funds have bought up and are now sitting vacant because it helps. It's just as profitable for them to leave them vacant without even taking the rental income on it. And that's how dysfunctional that is to a society, I suppose, even if it works for the managed funds. Emma, I'm just conscious. You must be saying it'd be great if we could have those conversations in the north, because you have a housing crisis as well, and you have housing issues, but you never get to talk about them because it's all these culture war nonsense.
That's right. We don't get to actually address any of the real problems that face people in the north and the housing crisis. I mean, we're looking at a whole generation here that's locked out of getting housing north and south. It is just. Yeah, we share some of that across the island.
I think we share a lot of it in terms of housing, health and education. So I think that was one of the things that we'd love to start talking about as we go along. I'm after bringing Harry Mac Evans on you on. Harry is Mr. Irish election projections, and the reason I brought him on is because, Harry, we've had three weeks of polls. We've seen the trend is one direction, and you're the man with the finger on the pulse. But you've also seen some of the stuff in the last 24 hours in terms of a newly populist Fine Gael. Harry, how have you read those polls? Harry, give us your insight.
Yeah, it's been really interesting because we've had a ton of polls this month, which is unusual from almost all the different pollsters. And it's, yeah, as you say, rightly say, Tony, it's going in one direction and it's looking increasingly good for Sinn Féin over this last month. I think there's a couple of things playing into that. We've seen, obviously, the housing being just such a huge thing at the moment. And it's a conversation that Fine Gael have decided to engage with, really full-bloodedly gone absolutely full-on into, particularly with the upcoming by-election in Dublin Bay South, where they were like, right, we're going to fight this on housing. And there's been polling data, not just the numbers of the parties, but there's been a fair bit of issue polling done over the last while, and it's very clear from that that while in general, across the board, Fine Gael generally have higher trust ratings on almost every single issue except for housing. So what Fine Gael are doing is they're going in being like, well, we can be the party of everything. We can be the party that solves the housing crisis, despite the fact that, you know, please don't pay any attention to what's happened over the last forever in the history of the state, particularly over the last few years, and are taking on Sinn Féin where Sinn Féin are strongest. And I think that's kind of something we're seeing as backfiring for them. I think there's a sense of this kind of flailing about in terms of what their message is on that. We've seen that where James Gagan has got absolutely hammered over the over his approach to it and the attempt to cast himself as the voice of a generation, of a locked out generation. And I think we're seeing a backlash to that in the polls. It's not convincing people. People are increasingly fed up and are going more and more towards Sinn Féin. The one thing I will say is that it's still the case, though, that for all of this, Fine Gael are still outperforming Sinn Féin in Dublin, which is still a very hard thing to figure out where and why that's coming from, given the impact of that overall and given the impact of the housing crisis in Dublin itself. But nationally, there's as big a gap as there's been for a very, very long time. I mean, you're looking at getting back towards where we were seeing, not quite at that level, but getting back towards that post-election surge Sinn Féin had, where immediately they shot up miles up in the polls after the election results were there and it became clear that they had an opportunity to form a government. So if it continues along this trend, we're definitely going to be looking at, you know, and we're a long way away from anything unless the government collapses, which is, I mean, it seems like it should be something that's likely, but I feel like they're going to be holding on very, very tightly for a very long time, particularly given recent stories about that have come out in the media about the likelihood of senior Fine Gael figures looking to retire at the end of this cycle, people like Simon Coveney and so on. I don't know if there's necessary truth to those, but those do add another reason that they would definitely not want to have any kind of soon election. The national trend is very, very clear. This is as big a surge as Sinn Féin have had for a long time. I think it does come back a lot to the treatment of the housing crisis. It comes back to Fine Gael strategically making, in my view, a poor decision to engage on that so heavily. But unless it changes in Dublin itself, there's going to be a cap sort of on how well Sinn Féin will be able to do out of it, because that should be fertile ground. They will pick up seats just from running more candidates. But that's where they really need to be able to make the breakthrough to push themselves into a position to form, if they want to lead a left government rather than a government that's propped up by Fianna Fáil, who have seen something of a recovery in the polls. It's going to be really, really tricky for them without getting that breakthrough in Dublin and working out where that next push is going to come from.
Can I just say about that subplot that Fianna Fáil have seen somewhat of a recovery in the polls, but on the other flip side of that coin, Fine Gael are dropping quite fast. There's coming to a crux point where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will have parity on popularity. And at that stage, it's anybody's game which one of them ends up the biggest party in opposition.
I think that would be very interesting if that happens. There is a way to go on that. But currently, yeah, the trend is downward for Fine Gael and upward for Fianna Fáil. It is worth noting that if there was an Ireland Thinks poll that came out, well, I think it was published this morning, but came out last night, which was also not good for Fine Gael, had them on 24, but that also had Fianna Fáil significantly lower on 15. There is an element here, and it's difficult to read the polls at the moment because you have the different polling companies are coming up with such radically different interpretations, mostly of Fianna Fáil's position. And it's difficult to say where that comes from. If you look at breakdowns, a lot of it's to do with support in Connacht Ulster. Some pollsters have them at like 10% there, others have them at 25%. It's difficult to parse that. I think what a lot of that is to do with is, and this is kind of the boring stuff, it's not that exciting politically, but it's to do with methodology. It's to do with the fact that you're getting very different results between face-to-face and online polls for Fianna Fáil in particular. So the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, that they're kind of in that sort of high teens kind of area between where they, some polls have them in the lower teens, some have them in the 20s. But if they end up in the same position as Fine Gael and we see that trend continue, that's absolutely disastrous from a Fine Gael point of view, because not only have they been comprehensively outmaneuvering Fianna Fáil publicly for the duration of this government, what you then have is you're going to a position where the Taoiseach rotation is going to change in next year, and you're not going to have Micheál Martin to hide behind anymore. Somebody, presumably Leo Varadkar, is going to be thrust into being the very much front and center face of this government, and not in the way that he's doing it at the moment, where he's kind of like, "Well, I'm going to talk about the government." But
he's the best commentator commentator, political commentator out there at the moment. He'd do really well if he had a column or a show on News Talk or something. He's been phenomenal at
Hollywood.
No, Hollywood. But actually, Emma, I'd be interested to because he comes in for a lot of crap in the north as well. Like, he's become a target. And I mean, a lot of it seems to be, you know, is it latent homophobia in some cases? I don't know. Like, I mean, there's just, I mean, I don't like the man's politics, but I can't stand the fact that he gets this level of abuse from certain sectors in the north. And it does seem to me to be laden with other issues other than actual politics.
Yeah, I would say there's probably a little bit of racism in there too. It is quite abhorrent in terms of the abuse that he does receive. He continues to be targeted, in particular by loyalists and some within unionism, as somehow being the architect of the Northern Ireland Protocol. I mean, gets a lot of credit for having designed something that he really didn't have any say in. It is really hard to see and witness. And I thought that he's handled himself extremely well in terms of that negative comments that he's received this week, with LCC saying that Irish politicians and ministers are not welcome north of the border. And of course, his response and rebuke to that was quite good, in him saying that he didn't think that the Loyalist Communities Council represented the majority of unionism or the majority of the people of Northern Ireland, and therefore don't have any say as to who is welcome in the north. But it is difficult to witness him going through that.
Yeah, and I actually, this sounds like a plug, but it's not, because we've launched a new podcast this week with Joella and Benita. It's called Built Different, and it's out since Saturday morning. But there's an interesting insight in that, where when Benita was actually, when Joella was Taoiseach for the day, a young woman, you know, person of color, and she had lunch at the desk with Leo Varadkar, just the two of them, having done the sort of photo ops and all the rest of it. And she said, she shares this on the podcast, about how he spoke about how he'd been a victim of racism. And she said, she actually says on the pod how she wished he'd speak out a bit more publicly about it, because it showed, you know, the systemic racism that is built into a lot of it. And I just thought it was an interesting insight. As I said, I disagree with the man on his politics, but I abhor some of the stuff that has been directed towards him. Harry, if I was to ask you, Dublin Bay South, you're still of the same mindset that I am, that even though James Gagan is doing his best, what is it, he's only opening his mouth to exchange his feet, but even though that's the way he's been going on, it's still his to lose by a long shot, a long shot for anybody else to take the seat.
Yeah, it's really tough, just given how friendly that constituency is for Fine Gael. It's a really, really tough one for anyone to win. I think, you know, there's Lynn Boylan's an extremely strong candidate, and realistically, Lynn Boylan is probably the only person who could challenge at this point. By-elections are weird, though. I would really emphasize that. All things being equal, you'd have to say it's very tough for Fine Gael to lose it. But by-elections are strange. Recent by-elections in Dublin, we've seen turnout in the 25% region. And if Sinn Féin can do two things, and they're going to be tough to do, but firstly, if turnout sort of in the southeast inner city local electoral area is much higher than it is in Kimmitrath Mines or Pembroke, particularly Pembroke, that will have a great leveling effect. And if Sinn Féin are able to activate a number of people, so if you see a drop off of regular voters, if Sinn Féin are able to actually have a get out the vote campaign that reaches people, again, particularly in the southeast inner city area. So that's sort of across, for people who don't know, that's sort of across near the river. You're talking like Ringsend through to Portobello. There is a potential there. It is a tough one. It does rely on there being a low turnout. So you'd have to say, if you were a betting man, it would be very tough not to put money down on Gagan at this point. But they've run a really weird campaign. They've come in for a ton of criticism, and it's not just the social media stuff. Like, Gagan has been getting absolutely hammered in the papers as well, and rightly so, for some of the things he said. I wouldn't rule it out entirely that Sinn Féin could take this, but you'd have to say it will take a really big change in the demographics, in the demographic turnout across that constituency at the moment. So it's not hopeless, but it's very, very big ask of them. I wouldn't be surprised to see Fine Gael get it by a good solid percentage.
Thanks for that, Harry. Tony, just going to turn to you for a second, and it's about populism. I'm going to ask you about populism.
Hold on.
We've seen it now just in the last 24 hours that Fine Gael are promising the sun, moon and stars. And yet, on the other hand, we also see this bill for increased Garda powers. It's kind of like we come in peace, shoot to kill. What do you think, Tony?
I think they're on an election footing, and it's unusual to see the promises that have been. Look, okay, it feels like we're picking on Leo Varadkar, but I'm not. I'm talking.
I said Fine Gael now. Fine Gael.
Yeah, but he made the statement. He made a speech, and he said, But you got to remember, this is also the same man who said, you know, you can't have rent freezes, you can't have bans on evictions, you can't have same-sex marriage, you can't have women going off for an abortion as the equivalent of women going to Amsterdam on a weekend with the lads. He said all these things, and he did the opposite politically. So maybe that's populism, Martin. That's probably, you know, so now he's promising 40,000 homes, he's promising a living wage. It's less than 6 months that he was writing to the EU saying, mind your own business when it comes to a living wage and collective bargaining directive. So, you know, again, it's electioneering, but he did deliver the things that he said he wouldn't do. So he delivered on some of the things that he said he wouldn't do. So maybe, you know, it's like when he said that he thinks he'll see a United Ireland in his lifetime. You have to, I know you can be skeptical, but you got to actually say, welcome, come on board. Nice to have you. Good. Come on in. Let's give him
But if it gains him votes, Tony, and Fine Gael get in again after,
it will gain him votes.
I know Harry thinks it's a while away to the next election, but that subplot, the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael thing, may force Fine Gael's hand when it comes to party. It's no use to stick in there with the ascendancy.
There was one other thing he said that was actually quite funny, and funny is the wrong word, but he did say this week about, you know, concerns over the ownership of the National Maternity Hospital, the same thing that he spoke against a year ago, that, you know, we had all of these things and Simon Harris said it was going to be grand and we didn't have to worry about. And now we're seeing, obviously, the cost has gone. I think it's gone from 500 million to 800 million. And, you know, it's again and again and again. Is that not good politics? Maybe. I don't know. People like me and you, Martin, we're not going to vote for him anyway. So he's not looking for our votes. He's not trying to change our minds.
But it's neither is that populist line from him gaining him any traction with his own people. Hardliners are hardliners, Tony.
Well, like if Paul Murphy came out and said, I'm going to build 40,000 houses, the first thing someone would have said is, where are you going to get the money for that? That's what it would have been put to.
Well, you have to see the money. You have to see the money.
So we can't have it both ways. I don't want to go on about it too much. I do want to mention a couple of things. I want to mention this is across the EU. It's Refugee Week. I know, and we spoke to the Lord Mayor of Belfast, Kate Nicol, and she was talking about some of the events she was at. It's really concerning me in the last few days, coming some of the stuff I've seen in the EU, digital fortress. They're using the pandemic to implement a new kind of digital barrier to the EU. So another way to keep people out. Denmark has passed a law that will mean that their asylum centers processing is done in another country outside of the EU, so no one can arrive in. They've also passed a law that says that if there's more refugees or more people from outside of Denmark in a certain community, they have to be displaced, because they didn't want that to create an issue. And, you know, we've seen what's happening with Hungary and Poland and all, but it's not just there. The numbers of people coming, we're in that seasonal flux. I mean, this is the time when people try to make the crossings, and we're seeing sound cannons being fired at boats in Greece. We're seeing these things being done, and it's been done in the EU, guys. That's what we like to talk about ourselves as some sort of bastion of democracy. This is all happening the last week or so. They're firing sound cannons at refugees. I mean, anybody else got a comment?
I just want to mention that on Wednesday, which is the 23rd, it's World Whistleblower Day. And we have asked our government, those of us who are interested in whistleblowing, are they going to mark it in any way? And they've said no, they're not going to mark World Whistleblower Day in any way. And we find that quite unusual. So we're going to ask people to put up the hashtag Whistleblowers Ireland. And it's worth remembering that across the EU, whistleblowers have exposed more financial wrongdoing than all of the regulators put together. And they have recovered more money, or led to the recovery of more money, than all the regulators put together. So whistleblowers save you money. So support them. And I just wanted to mention that.
I suppose I'll just mention the refugee point there. I think that, it's something that's not talked about enough or discussed enough or well enough known, that the EU has always actually had a very hard border when it comes to non-EU citizens. And their policies towards refugees have never been as humane or just as we might like to think that they are. And I think that there is a rising growth of anti-immigrant rhetoric and positions and policies that are emerging across a number of governments. I wrote about the UK government's policies towards asylum seekers and refugees recently, and it is appalling. And we often discuss how appalling the UK's system is, whilst also ignoring the issues and how appalling some of the systems are within the EU as well. So, yeah, I just want to echo that point that it's an area that's not scrutinized anywhere near as much as it should be.
Yeah, I think on the refugee thing, there's a really core dysfunction with what one of the EU's principles there, which is the free movement of people. And the problem is, this is why I think it's really tough to resolve this kind of behavior, which is appalling from the European Union, that should be, as it puts, a moral leader and a democratic leader. If you have free movement of people within your group, your organization, you have to, by necessity, be very strict in not allowing people who aren't in your group that same free movement, or else the benefits of your club aren't worth anything, because anyone who turns up can do the same thing. And I think that's part of what drives it, why the national level decisions made by governments are disgusting in terms of how they handle it. But the reason that it's very difficult for the EU as an institution to address is that by one of its core founding principles, it struggles to reconcile that idea of free movement of people within the EU with free movement of people into the EU. Because if you can do the first, you can do the second. And if you can do the first, you don't need to be a member of the EU to avail of the second. And that is why there's just this institutional inability. And we see these horrible things like sound cannons and people being literally kicked into the sea and put in camps and left to drown. And until that is resolved, until that free movement of people is taken away from that neoliberal, I suppose, for want of a better word, implementation of it, interpretation of it that lies at the heart of the EU, we're not going to see a resolution on this, and it's not going to come from these national governments that are, as has been rightly pointed out, are increasingly anti-asylum seeker and anti-immigrant and just xenophobic in general. So it's a really tough one, and it's depressing to think about, because until that sort of core EU institution and core EU approach changes in itself, the union isn't going to do a lot to fix that problem, and will indeed probably continue to make it worse.
I'm going to have to move us on and just going to point out, Emma, did you see our spinning, high-kicking waiter from South Frederick Street? Did you see the clip? George's Street.
No.
Well, this guy, I don't know, was he 6 foot odd, Tony?
Look, all Mark wants to know is a video went around of a brawl in Dublin, but the waiter, Harry, you saw this, the man did a spinning back kick that failed to connect. But I'm wondering, Orla, if you maybe noticed, because all I noticed was him getting propositioned for hours afterwards, saying hi, I saw that spinning back kick, and I'm free tomorrow evening if you're free. So it was a gentle reminder that yes, you all think you're all higher beings and all that sort of stuff, but you know what? A man who can throw a spinning back kick definitely gets the women, unlike political nerds like us. But
I do think, though, that there's a lot of focus being put on what we'll call a skirmish or a fight in town. I mean, pre-pandemic, that happened every night of the week, and nobody noticed, or nobody thought that it was anything that we should be mentioning. And it also filled hospitals. I mean, that was the huge, and I'm dying to see when they crunch the numbers after all of this. Did closing the pubs actually increase health overall across the community? And would it be a great health measure to do for the future? You know, I'm really interested to see.
That's just because you only drink Blue Wicked.
Yeah, but I think that should be the national drink, Tony.
I think it has distracted, you know, unfairly from how successful outdoor dining has been in town. And there's a great buzz and atmosphere, and, you know, people are, and luckily it's been dry weather for the last week or 10 days. I think, you know, when you see clips like that, it is misleading actually as to what the atmosphere generally is in town and how many people are out.
Yeah, and I think it's not just Dublin. I think it's in any small town across the country, you'll find the same kind of instances. And it's really portraying Dublin. I mean, I know we have problems, but, you know, mayhem and disorder aren't the biggest problem we have in Dublin, by a long shot.
I know Vicky's working on something for police, on the new police powers, the new bill, and how difficult, how much more enhanced they are. I mean, I don't know, Harry, I don't think you'd want to be handing over your phone for them just to have a look through your social media here. know. There's a lot of things in this that seem to be a bit of a power grab. And I know the Irish Council for Civil Liberties have concerns about it as well. So it'll be interesting. I won't speak about it. We let Vicky, the expert, speak about it when she's ready to go, Martin.
Yeah, it's interesting, the timing as well. If I was a party in decline, I wouldn't be handing my inevitable successors excessive powers to quell me. I wouldn't be doing it. It's not politically astute.
We might leave it there for the week that was, guys. Look, you know, we are going to be taking a couple of weeks off in the summer, believe it or not. We'll take a couple of Sundays off, but we will continue to do these as long as people can get benefit of them. We really appreciate you listening. If you want to come along, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I want to thank Harry, Orla and Emma again for joining us and giving us a brilliant insight into all different aspects. And if anybody wants to throw up any questions now or whatever, or throw up the hand, I'm happy to hang on for a few more minutes. Thanks, guys.